Gang, and welcome to National Bugle Radio. This is your host, Patrick Slattery. This week, I talked to Professor Andrew Joyce about his article on Muslim immigration into Europe and also about the Jewish role in promoting that Muslim immigration, the history behind it. Let's take a listen. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be back again.
Could you elaborate some on that?
Yeah, well, you pointed out the pattern there of Jews are importing Muslim immigrants. Muslim immigrants have traditional hostilities towards Jews. They act upon those hostilities, and Jews use that as a pretext to increase their own security and restrict the freedoms of the rest of us. Well, in that article, I think, and certainly in a number of other articles, I elaborated upon a theory of mine. It's not particularly abstract. It might not even be so much a theory as an argument to the fact that, you know, Jews for centuries, and I'm talking about going back to the 12th century at least, have been very conscious and places a high priority this issue of community security for themselves within Europe. And going back to the 12th century, 13th centuries, Jews were able to ensure that security through alliances with the nobles or with the elite in the form of the monarch. So if Jews were performing a task or role that was useful to the king, for example, in tax farming or otherwise in money lending for wars and so on and so forth, then the king would reciprocate with that by allowing the Jews to come under his own protection. So the royal guards would offer physical protection for Jews as they went about collecting money, as they went about their daily lives and protecting their community in a geographical sense also. But that protection also extended into the statute books in the form of a decree, and that was that as the king's property, and that's how they were described in many cases, an assault upon the Jews was an assault upon the king.
I just want to stop just for a second, because it just flies so much in the face of what people tend to think about Jewish history in Europe, where they were oppressed. To the extent they were property, it was, people think of them as being almost like chattel slaves, incessant pogroms. But the picture you're painting is really one of both privilege and a protected ability to exploit the native population.
Exactly. The issue here is special status. And this is something that is very cleverly worked around within Jewish historiography and is not much discussed as Jews seek to continue with this portrait of themselves and their history as being one of victimhood. Jews, as far as I'm concerned, and anyone who looks at the history objectively, clearly had an elite status within medieval society. They were not on the level of peasants. They were significantly higher than it and enjoyed protections and privileges far superior to that of the average peasant. And in some cases, above that even of the strata of nobles, which came under the king. So the level of protection was high. The status was privileged. And this endured for a considerable number of centuries. And when you look at Eastern Europe, Poland, in parts of northern Ukraine, and all of those bits and pieces of several countries, modern states, that then comprise what was known as the Pale of Settlement within the old Russian Empire. Within that nobility system that existed there, Jews enjoyed special privileges and protections right up to the 19th century. And many of those privileges were in the form of protection, but certainly there were economic privileges going right up to that date.
So what I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but many people would ask, well, why did princes and kings employ Jews to exploit the prince's own fellow countrymen?
It's an excellent question. One of the answers lies in the fact that Jews, whether they're protected or not, whether they are socially and economically privileged or not, remain outsiders. And if the going got tough, if the tension came to breaking point, if the peasantry was exploited...
This is the alternative media.
Then when the levy broke, so to speak, it would be convenient to have an outsider to scapegoat. Mm-hmm. Now, Jews have expanded that genuine role of the scapegoat in astronomical terms and have woven it into their narrative of victimhood. But they really eagerly accepted this rule because, on the whole, the odds were that the nobles would be able to suppress the dissent and any peasant uprisings and so on and so forth.
So it's part and parcel of the bargain that they had, basically.
It's absolutely part and parcel of the bargain. They were fully aware of what they were getting themselves in for. And even in situations, for example, just prior to their expulsion from England in 1290, there were a number of incidents which prefigured the eventual expulsion and which didn't look very good or promising to the Jewish population, but they held on because they believed that, you know, that the bargain would hold true and that in any event, the profitability of being able to farm taxes, to money lend to the peasantry, to money lend to the nobility, the profits at stake so far outweighed in their extravagance any potential danger. So it was a worthy risk. Think of it as quite a sure bet. The odds were in their favor. That's how they saw it. So that's why they endured with this agreement. Mm-hmm. But the point I'm trying to make, as I sort of skip over this great span of Jewish European history, is that a common feature throughout all those centuries was special protection. Mm-hmm. This is something that became more complicated with the advent of democracy, because you no longer can lobby a king or a local noble. The politics behind achieving those kinds of freedoms and privileges and what have you become a lot more elaborate. Mm-hmm. So, yes, democracy brings with it certain things like not so much human rights at first, but the idea of equality and citizenship, and bound up within a lot of these universal privileges, if you want to call it that, were universal responsibilities, one of which was to the rule of law and certain codes of conduct in society. So there was a kind of built-in protection for Jews within democracy, and certainly their liberal democracy. But it doesn't protect them from critique to the extent that they would like. And certainly with the great upswell of anti-Jewish opinion across Europe, really beginning in the 1890s, but reaching its peak in the 1930s, throughout Central Europe in particular, and very much so its epicenter in Eastern Europe, certainly Poland, Lithuania, and Ukraine during the Second World War, the vulnerability of democracy in terms of being able to offer adequate protections to Jews, at least as perceived by Jews, was shown. And I believe that since the Second World War in particular, Jews have been looking for new strategies for heightened protection of themselves. In explicit terms, this has been in the form of Holocaust denial laws, where basically the population at large has its freedom of speech, or certainly other freedoms also, restricted so that Jews can feel more safe. And this also bleeds into speech laws, which have been introduced across Europe and also in Australia, Canada, not the United States yet. But these hate speech laws, we've had the creation of what's now called hate crime. And we've had calls for specific outlawing of anti-Semitism, to make anti-Semitism illegal, certainly throughout the EU. And that call was made by Moshe Kantor, the head of one of the great Jewish organizations in Europe. And, one of the latest emergences from this elixir of attempts to stifle the freedoms of the European peoples has been the upsurge in efforts to restrict freedom on the internet. And that is something that the Anti-Defamation League is heavily involved in. That is also something that the European Union is seriously considering. And certainly there are a number of British Jewish academics who are at the forefront of trying to formulate a workable policy document that can be eventually assented to. So we are witnessing the evolution of Jewish security systems, and the more securities and special privileges and special statuses that are afforded to Jews, the less freedoms the rest of us will have. And we only need to look back at medieval society for some kind of parallels there.
Okay. Now, you had said that they enjoyed these protections from the princes, from the rulers, up until the 19th century. Now, in the 19th century, you had, I guess starting with Napoleon, this movement towards emancipation, what was called emancipation. Now, of course, in the United States, emancipation is typically refers to the freeing of the slaves. Now, the Jews were not slaves, and as you described, they were actually very privileged. So the emancipation was, I guess, the end of this formal system of separation where, you know, on the one hand, it allowed them to participate directly in some of the newer institutions, the parliaments. On the other hand, perhaps it took away some of their past privileges. So I have a few questions. What were the Jewish attitudes in various countries towards emancipation? Was it something that they had been pushing for or something that they were ambivalent about? Did this emancipation lead to an increase in anti-Semitism among the rest of the population? I think it's a Professor Margaret Anderson at Stanford, or maybe she's at Berkeley. She did a lecture series, and it started with a story about a police officer somewhere in, I think, Bavaria, maybe it was in Munich, and he was going somewhere, and he had a what they called a cab. It must have been a horse-drawn cab. This would have been around 1870. The cab driver was Jewish, and the cab driver stopped somewhere and took a long time doing something personal. When he came back to the cab, the police officer cursed at him and cursed at him in an anti-Semitic manner, and this cab driver was able to take the policeman to court over his violations of what would have been 19th century hate speech laws. I'm not sure what they exactly would have been called, but this is how she started one of her lectures. So the questions are, what were the Jewish attitudes towards emancipation? Did the emancipation lead to an increase in anti-Semitism? Did it lead to, in some countries, perhaps, you know, in Germany or Prussia or in Austria, did it lead to some formal protections? What types of formal protections were there?
I'll tackle the first question first. The word emancipation is actually a very interesting one, especially when we're talking about the 19th century and when we're looking specifically at Eastern Europe. For me, the standout emancipation of that period was not the emancipation of the Jews, because the Jews were not emancipated, because they didn't need to be emancipated in Eastern Europe. The real emancipation was that of the serfs, the great mass of the peasantry, mm-hmm. who were, you know, laboring under the nobles, who were, of course, the strata under the Tsar himself. Now, what were Jewish attitudes to the emancipation of the serfs? I would argue is the more interesting and pressing inquiry. And the answer there would be that they weren't at all happy about it. And actually, there are a number of historians, Jewish historians, who in this century have remarked that the emancipation of the serfs was not good for the Jews. Why was that? Well, when the serfs were firmly under the nobles and effectively were chattel slaves, when they were under the thumb of the nobles, they had to follow certain social conducts and patterns of behavior, and this extended to their economic life. And the noble, if he, and in many cases he did, in most cases he did, had a Jew as his primary financial arbiter, then the main middleman between the noble and the serfs would be the Jew. In many cases, this involved the Jew running the taverns of the noble, mm-hmm. and the trade in alcohol was extremely lucrative. Obviously, the production of vodka, Jews would run the mills and the grain stores and everything of the noble also, so a lot of this serfs' production was converted back into alcohol and then more or less sold back onto the serfs themselves. In many cases, it was sold to them on credit. So you would find yourself in a position where, say you were a serf, you've been out working in the field all day. Well, you had to go afterwards to the tavern. You were compelled to. You had to.
You were compelled to by the landlords.
The landlord would set a quota of money that the serf would have to spend in his tavern. And this was a miserable existence. So alcohol and alcoholism was endemic. And it may be in there somehow as one of the reasons why it's still a bit of a problem in modern Russia. Uh-huh. But, you know, alcoholism was a problem among the serfs, and they would go to these taverns and they would get drunk. And there are many, many folk tales of serfs going to the tavern, getting drunk, and when they wake up in the morning, there's this huge tab that has been built up overnight. And a lot of folk tales relate to the fact that that tab may or may not have been genuine. In other words, the Jewish tavern keeper may have seen that this particular serf was getting blind drunk and thought, well, he's not going to remember how much he's drank overnight, so I'll just add a few more drinks onto the bill. So that was one problematic aspect of Jewish tavern keeping, so it was dishonesty. But another was that it was a vehicle for money lending. A serf, if he wanted to buy a new piece of furniture or anything really, could also ask the tavern keeper for a loan. And he could put any amount of his possessions up as collateral for that loan. So we see the beginnings of pawnbroking in that part of the Russian Empire. And then when mass emigration out of the Russian Empire by Jews occurred in the 1890s, a lot of it was brought to the United States. So that's when you get a lot of Jewish pawnbroking really taking off the United States for the first time as an industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Jews brought it with them out of the tavern system of the Russian Empire. But the money lending was a real aspect of the economic life within those taverns, and that was also highly profitable. So as long as the serf was kept in that lowly position and made to keep going to the tavern, made to just keep putting himself at the mercy of this economic machine, then that was good for the Jews. They made plenty of money. Plenty of money was made in the tavern system. When that system ended, when the serfs were emancipated and they gained freedom and they gained economic independence in terms of where they spent their money, how they spent their money, and in many cases when the Russian state government made a decree that the tavern system itself should be broken up and made subject to more capitalistic free market impulses rather than delegated out as a favor by the noble to his Jews, then Jewish ownership of the tavern started to slip. And in many localities, Jews were actually increasingly banned in these increasingly democratic societies from holding on to those taverns. And while you may have heard lots of propaganda about the Tsarist pogroms and the purges and everything were happening and that's why Jews left Russia, they didn't. The drift of Jews out of Russia started much earlier, and the reason that it started much earlier and the reason why it started around the 1840s, 1850s, mm-hmm. is because that underpinning of their economic life in Russia in the form of that protected, privileged status with the nobles had been undermined. That parasitic economic life was being slowly broken up, and Jews didn't know how to cope within that environment. And also, think about the centuries of resentments that had been building up in that time. A Jew who loses that privileged status overnight isn't going to find, you know, a friendly Gentile neighbor who's going to offer him a job in the mill or whatever it might have mm-hmm. been. He wouldn't have wanted that kind of job anyway. But it seemed a much more lucrative option to just to travel across Europe and get a steamship to the United States and there to continue with a money lending enterprise or whatever it might be. And certainly the vast majority of Jews who landed mm-hmm. in the United States in the 1880s, 1890s, and a few decades before were overwhelmingly orientated in an economic sense towards those kind of professions, money lending, loan merchants, pawnbroking, petty trade, and many industries like that.
Well, this is very... I think back to the Civil War, the American Civil War, and a decree by General Ulysses S. Grant towards the end of the war that forbid Jews from Confederate territory that he had occupied, because the Jews had come in for all sorts of, you know, this type of petty trading, but a very exploitive type of petty trading, which he saw as being damaging to his control of the land. And I bring it up because you think of the big wave of Jewish immigration to the United States, especially that came from Eastern Europe, as being somewhat later, in the 1880s, 1890s, early 20th century. But these people that he would have been banning, these small traders who were coming from the north, they would be part of this, you know, earlier wave of immigration from the east that you're talking about. There have been Sephardic Jews in the United States from the very beginning, but they would have already been in the South. They were already elite. They were the slave traders, and this is why the earliest and oldest synagogues in the United States are mostly in places like Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia, which were slave trading centers. So these carpetbagger type of Jews who were coming in towards the end of the Civil War that were causing trouble for General Grant, these would have been these Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe who would have come in during that time period you're saying, as serfdom was on its way out as a economic and social system in Russia. So that would be the reflection of it in American history.
Yeah, you're exactly right. They would have been the vanguard of the increasingly larger immigration of Russian Empire Jews towards the end of that particular century. But you're right, I had heard that before, but it hadn't come to mind, but it's a very, very good point to make, and it's very worthwhile raising it also. It's a naturally an instinctively antagonistic form of trade. It generates a lot of friction. And I think the second part of your question earlier was, did the emancipation of the Jews contribute to anti-Semitism? The answer, in a roundabout kind of way, would be that I don't think that there were any great changes in what Jews did, and nor do I believe that there was any great change in what anti-Semitism was or the extent of it. What I believe happened in the latter part of the 19th century was that an increased sense of peoplehood developed among the European peoples in terms of national identities and so on. We know that the development of nationalism was a 19th century phenomenon, really, in the state sense. But another thing that I think happened within the 19th century is that the Jewish population exploded. We know that it was absolutely booming in Eastern Europe in the 19th century because of the profitability of the industries that they'd been involved in, the money lending. It was so lucrative. The Jews were able to have and sustain these huge families. And of course, the Hasidic movement was born in the 19th century also in Eastern Europe. And that's whole communities whose way of life is not to work. And they didn't have to work because there were such rich money lenders and loan merchants who were able to make vast donations into this community, effectively sustaining it with money derived by usury from the Gentile community. So you have a very hard-pressed peasantry, and all of the resources from that peasantry are being pumped into a Jewish community, which makes, as its life philosophy, a matter of course of not working. So you know, the absurdity of the situation is very plain to see in that example alone. But it's very, very antagonizing. Now, when the Jewish population is relatively small, as it was in Western Europe in the first half of the 19th century in the United States also, you mentioned those Sephardic families who were engaged in the slave trade and what have you, but they're in small enough numbers that they're not noticeable to the great mass. Mm-hmm. But when you have, you know, millions upon millions upon millions of Ostjuden or Eastern Jews pouring across the continent of Europe, pouring across the United States and moving down to South Africa, and they're everywhere, and they're moving into every town, and they're in every village, and you know, they're setting up these little stores where they're selling things on credit, and they're money lending enterprises, and they're pawnbroking, and they're selling, you know, loans at really high interest, then more and more people in more and more diverse geographical areas are exposed to Jewish capitalism. And what it does is, it's not necessarily that Jews are doing anything differently. It's not necessarily that the context among Europeans is vastly different. It's that the scale of things has expanded dramatically. And
partly with their expanded population and then the accompanying expansion of their geographic distribution.
Precisely. It's my personal belief that anti-Semitism arises from contact with Jews who are behaving in a certain antagonistic fashion, whether that's economically, politically, or socially. So if Jews are a small proportion of the population, a very, very small proportion of the population, and that presence, that antagonism is not felt on a large scale, then anti-Semitism will not be a feature of the national life. But as that population increases and those frictions are occurring more and more and across a more diverse geographical area, then of course you will see an upswell in anti-Semitism, and you will see the development of what have been described as anti-Semitic movements, mm-hmm. whether they are political movements or social movements. So it is no accident that the development of political anti-Semitism in Central Europe and throughout the West occurred in the second half of the 19th century, when the Jewish population peaked. And when it peaked, not only numerically, but geographically, in terms of its spread, in terms of the areas it covered, in terms of its economic life, in terms of its political life, in terms of its social expression. Mm-hmm. So the reaction is as widespread as the contagion, if you want to use that kind of terminology, as controversial as it might be. Mm-hmm. But it's quite logical, to my mind, to see that pattern, rather than to ascribe the rise in anti-Semitism, as Jewish intellectuals have, to a crisis of Western civilization, psychological trauma, the authoritarian personality, or any number of other quite unprovable and unpackable theories.
No, I mean, what you just laid out, that anti-Semitism is a response to Jewish adversarial behavior. And if you have an expansion of Jewish community, both in terms of population and geographic distribution, provided they continue with the same type of adversarial behavior, then necessarily you would have an increase in anti-Semitism as a result.
Precisely. And we therefore arrive at a position in the early 20th century where things begin to reach ahead and where it becomes increasingly remarked upon that Jews have acquired prominence in political, social, and cultural fields that is deemed to be detrimental to the interests of the great mass of the population. And at this point, political anti-Semitism gains a vitality. We see in the late 19th century, you know, the Dreyfus case occurs in France, which brings a lot of sort of barely suppressed antagonisms to the surface there. In Britain, there were a number of scandals involving Jewish members of parliament who occupied high positions in the British Empire. The Marconi scandal, the Indian silver scandal.
The Marconi scandal?
There were a number of suspect loans given to various companies, including the Marconi Radio Company.
Okay.
And there were lots of backhanders, and there was lots of ethnic nepotism at play there in a number of high-profile financial scandals within the British Empire that related to really a handful of Jewish families that acquired a very, very significant number of imperial positions. The Nathan family, the Montagues, the Goldsmiths, the Rothschilds being one of the more obvious families at play there. But the same pattern is repeated in Germany and Austria. The subject of Jewish influence becomes part of common speech, part of the common political discourse. The mainstream media attempts to sort of stifle it in various ways because it's already bought up in large part by Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So there's sort of an antagonism there between the establishment opinion, and there are those who come out who are claim to be very much against anti-Semitism, and then there's this upswell, this constant sort of agitated upswell from the people themselves, mm-hmm. these national movements who wish to define themselves in ethnic terms, very often against what they perceive to be a anti-national, cosmopolitan, ultra-capitalistic, in a perverse sense also. And I think this is worth getting into in a bit more detail, this Judeo-Bolshevik influence as well. This entity which seeks for the breaking down of tradition, for the breaking down of all that which was prior. So just a maelstrom in late 19th century Europe, early 20th century Europe, of political, social ideas. And at the center of all this is that Jewish antagonism and that Jewish adversarial behavior that you described.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned there this idea of Jews being both ultra-capitalist and then also involved in Judeo-Bolshevism, which seem to be polar opposites when looked at superficially. To my mind, one of the more fascinating tricks that Jews have ever pulled off is their portrayal of themselves as members of the proletariat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it would seem, based on what I discussed earlier, given the privileged status and position of Jews within the Russian Empire, that for them to portray themselves as being quite like the serfs during that period would be absurd.
Right.
Certainly is absurd.
And now serfdom was abolished in Russia, I believe, something like 1867. Was that the year? Plus or minus a couple of years?
At the latest.
Yeah.
At the latest. As a process, it had probably been going on in piecemeal fashion for at least 50 years before mm-hmm. that.
Okay.
Incrementally. It's stunning. There's this gap then. How did Jews go from being this privileged population which gets to run the taverns and exploit the peasantry and all the rest of it to suddenly flipping around and saying, look, hey, we're the workers too? It's quite complex in some ways and quite simple in others.
So, I mean, were there Jewish workers in factories who were working alongside non-Jewish workers? Was that at all common?
I mean, not everyone was able to emigrate to the United States when the tavern system broke down and when the old systems fell apart. And many of them went into manufacturing, but they didn't go into manufacturing alongside Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't work alongside non-Jews. In many cases, a Jewish capitalist who had made a very significant amount of money while the going was good and got out of tavern keeping and had diversified just prior to the demise of that system, if he opened up a number of factories, he would employ Jewish workers. So there is a intact and self-contained economy within that early Russian industrial economy, which is exclusively Jewish. So there are Jewish factory workers, but they operate within a very separate social ethical system to the situation of Gentiles working in different factories within the broader capitalist system.
And I have a specific question. In the United States, we have a Socialist Workers' Party. I don't know how similar it is to the Socialist Workers' Party in Britain that features people like Tariq Ali. But we have this party. It's a Trotskyite party. And one of its features is that it sends people into factories, into the coal mines, as propagandists and organizers and, what would you call it, provocateurs maybe. So you had that. Actually, it's ongoing today. They still do it today. And people like who we talked about in a previous show, Noel Ignatius.
Ignatieff.
Noel Ignatieff. He wasn't with the Socialist Workers' Party. He was with a different Communist Party. But that's what he did before he was then admitted without a bachelor's degree to the PhD program at Harvard. Did Jews 100-something years ago, before the Bolshevik Revolution, did they engage in this type of activity or not?
No. I believe that the real hotbed of revolutionary thought among the Jews in the 19th century Russian Empire was not born in coal mines or in factories or in fields. The revolutionaries who were really worth anything and achieved anything in 19th century Russian Empire were commonly from middle class or upper middle class Jewish mercantile families. They were university educated, and while at university, they operated within an exclusively Jewish social milieu, and they exchanged ideas. And one of the fuels of the fire for lots of those intellectual discussions was a deep burning resentment against the Russian state, the Tsarist system, which had quite clearly been responsible for the destruction of the old tavern system and the removal of the power of the nobles, and ultimately the toppling of Jews from their once privileged position. Mm-hmm. There's a real resentment there, but that resentment is very, very different from that of the masses. Now, there are communistic, socialistic urges among the peasantry who still feel oppressed and still feel that they've been moved out of one type of serfdom and into the other in the form of slaving away in the factories. But it's very different in character from the deep-seated hostility and hate that the Jewish intellectuals feel towards those responsible for their disprivileging with the end of the tavern system.
I have a question, and I probably should know better, but the upheavals in Europe of 1848, where you had the Paris Commune formed, what was the Jewish involvement in that?
I'm certain the Jews were involved on some level, though it was not prominent. And for socialism and even sort of communistic socialism in the early part of the 19th century, wasn't really Jewish. In fact, in some cases, it was anti-Semitic. As late as 1876, in the Ukraine, there were a great many communist officials who were dedicated to the doctrine of Marx, who did not like Jews. And they didn't want Jews in the Communist Party because they didn't see how Jews could be communist. You know, one Ukrainian communist revolutionary actually wrote to his commander, who was saying that we're going to be working with these Jewish intellectuals and, you know, we want to have some Jewish commissars and what have you. And this guy actually wrote to his commander and he said, but the weight of the Jews' exploitation is great and their harmfulness is unlimited. If we find it possible to preach revolution and only revolution against the nobles, how can we defend the Jews? So here's a guy his mind is boggling. He's thinking to himself, look, how can we react against the nobles while ignoring the people who really did the dirty work for the nobles quite happily and very profitably for centuries? And this antagonism within Eastern European socialism, communism, towards the idea of Jews being able to be seen as part of the proletariat. And I would argue that that is only overwhelmed in the end through clever dialogue by Jewish intellectuals like Trotsky, who preach outwardly, at least, this kind of universalistic dogma where they take communism, socialism. I'm not going to use the term Marxism because Marxism is quite different, but they take the kind of grassroots antipathy towards hypercapitalists, and these Jewish intellectuals preach into that an anti-national sentiment. So that they strip out any kind of national or ethnic element to it. And in fact, they forbid it and declare it as antithetical to the interests of the proletariat, which is completely paradoxical, but it is successful. That is the heart of Judeo-Bolshevism and why it differs from what I would regard as real socialism.
Okay.
And that is that the national element is viewed as intrinsically hostile. And the reason for that being that theory and that worldview is formulated by Jews.
In some cultures, the bat is seen as two-faced, because on the one hand, he can go to the birds and say, look, I'm with you, I have wings, and then he can go to the mammals and say, look, I'm with you, I have fur. And I've often brought that saying up with regards to the Jewish ability in modern-day United States or Europe or Australia to say to the minority population, I'm an oppressed minority too, I'm with you, but then also to pass themselves off as white when it's convenient to them. Now, what you're saying here with regards to early Bolshevism or early Marxism, the Jewish ability, or at least their attempt, to pass themselves off as proletariat, where their actual history had been very much to the contrary. And then, of course, when you're talking about Judeo-Bolshevism, the Judeo-Bolshevism that was in the speeches and writings of Hitler, the Judeo-Bolshevism of the, say, 1920s and 1930s that caused the massive forced famine in the Ukraine and parts of Russia, the Jews have been, at least as far as they're reflected in history, they have been able to represent the Bolshevik leadership as being communist in nature and take away the Jewish aspects of it. It's not widely known that Lenin was part Jewish and had a Jewish identity. It's not widely known. It's also not widely known that even overlooking Lenin, half of the Politburo was consistently Jewish. But also you had the Jews as the middlemen between the leadership in Moscow who were actually enforcing these policies on the Ukraine and the Russian countryside where the famine took place. So you had this, I don't know, I mean, I'm sure that the people at the time in that area were aware of who was enforcing these policies on them, and that's why the Ukrainians at the time were very supportive of Hitler's armies when they invaded. But it seems that so much has been forgotten since then. And even if you look at the Ukrainian nationalist parties today, some of them are explicitly anti-Semitic, but so many of them, I think like the Right Sector and those who wound up being the actual muscle in the overthrow of President Yanukovych, that they wound up being willing to ally themselves with Jewish power in opposition to Russian. So it would seem that they even forgot the lessons of their grandparents. So there's two places I want to go with the rest of the conversation. One is, you've talked about Judeo-Bolshevism, and you did make some sort of references to its complete dismemberment of traditional social structures like the family, and I'd like to cover that. I'd also like to cover the modern days, where you have so much antagonistic Jewish behavior, yet there's an almost total lack of anti-Semitism, and I know you have an explanation for that. So that's where I'd like to go with the rest of this conversation. So would you like to start with an explanation of what you mean and what was understood to be meant by Judeo-Bolshevism?
Yeah, I think I finished up my last point on Judeo-Bolshevism by saying that essentially it was genuine grassroots socialism with any kind of national or ethnic or ethno-social element stripped out of it. So it becomes a battering ram against the nation rather than a upswelling of the peasantry of a nation against exploitative interests. So it changes the character of it fundamentally. But many other things are preached into that along with it. It is ultimately a very hateful creed. In fact, it's Marxism and Judeo-Bolshevism is the ultimate hate speech because it is built on centuries of resentments, more or less suppressed, but always seething, always present, and hostility towards things like the family, towards the church, towards the idea of the social community with social obligations and norms, middle class respectable behavior, culture, music, even humor. Lots of these aspects of life were viewed with deep suspicion and hatred by Jewish populations who were always living cheek by fragile with these peasant populations who could rise up against them at any moment. There's lots of mutual suspicions there, and then lots of that feeds into the suspicion, hatred, and violence of the Judeo-Bolshevik creed. Judeo-Bolshevism ultimately isn't really about economics. I'm writing a piece at the minute on Jewish involvement in the open borders movement, and I state in it that it's not really about Marxism either, that involvement. It's not even really about open borders per se or nationality. It's about the expression of Jewish grievances and how they are expressed and why they are expressed and the hatreds that underpin all of those actions. And Judeo-Bolshevism isn't really about who gets paid a fair amount for his kind of work or about how a national economy should be run. It's not about that. It's about exacting revenge. It's about positions of power. It's about influence within a given society. All of those Jews who were, you know, freed up by the Red Army or what have you from Tsarist oppression did not happily take up shovels and take part in the national social experiment of communism, Marxism. No, many of them just drifted into elite positions within that society where they got to sit around like fat cats all day discussing theory and swigging alcohol and smoking cigars, mm-hmm. while the much-hated serf, whose family had been destroyed and whose culture had been dismantled, was out slaving in the field or starving to death.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a system of revenge. It's not an economic system. It's one of the cardinal sins that many of our young leftist dupes of Gentile extraction are committing today, those who join the Antifa or the Communist parties, wherever they may be in Europe or throughout the West. They are convinced by an economic argument, but they are completely blindsided by the fact that this creed that they have thrown their lot in with is not really about economics, mm-hmm. at all. It's not really an ethical system.
So you called Judeo-Bolshevism a system of revenge. It's a system of destruction, and it had in its sights traditional social institutions like the family, the destruction of the family, the destruction of the nation, national identity, destruction of religion, both in terms of its religious ideas and physical attributes of religion, like churches. They were destroyed, icons were destroyed, and probably other institutions that I'm not thinking of. But that's all part of Judeo-Bolshevism, am I correct?
Precisely.
Is it reflected today in what many writers from the right describe as cultural Marxism? Is that the 21st century version of this?
Precisely. And lots of writers on the right and speakers on the right have made this great deal of how Marxism changed. It developed into this new thing. It stopped being about communism and it found a new way into the West. But they themselves have missed the point. They've missed the point that I've just made, which is that Judeo-Bolshevism was never about economics in the first place. It can wear many hats, and that's why it can just as easily pick up a capitalist hat and walk into your university and start preaching feminism and transgender rights as easily as it can walk into a field full of Russian peasants in the 19th century and start preaching hatred against the noble.
And preach open borders.
Or preach open borders. It can wear many, many hats. And this ability, as you described the analogy of the bat, you know, Jews are experts at wearing many masks. You know, they are the ultimate ethno-nationalists in Israel, but they are also the ultimate universalists and open borders advocates, mm-hmm. where in other places. They are the ultimate communists in the form of Judeo-Bolshevism, but they are the ultimate capitalists in the form of money lending and Goldman Sachs and having power in the Federal Reserve. And there is no contradiction here. They can be both, because they aren't either. They are never just capitalists, they are never just communists, they are never just an ethno-nationalist. The Jewish identity underpinning all of those things permits the wearing of many hats, and in fact encourages it. So, yes, you know, we have cultural Marxism today, which is another name for Judeo-Bolshevism, which isn't as explicit on ideas of economic planning or whatever it might be, but in terms of its rather disgustingly, hypocritically described social justice expressions, it is as alive and kicking as it ever was in the Soviet Union, and is certainly increasing in power at a very frightening pace, mm-hmm. in the shape of multiculturalism, the open borders movement. It's behind the refugee crisis. it's in our media encouraging us to be more tolerant. We need to be more diverse. Diversity is strength, etc., etc. All of these slogans all pour forth from a single origin, and that is a Judeo-Bolshevist origin.
Okay.
And it is incredibly harmful, and it is a hateful creed that is able to mask itself very well.
Okay, Professor Joyce, I want to get to this issue of today, where we have what would have to be historic levels of antagonistic behavior by Jews, historic power, historic distribution geographically, and yet, with the exception of this so-called alt-right and a few other corners, you've had a few people like Malaysian Prime Minister Mohamed Mahathir who speak out, but virtually no public anti-Semitism. So what is the explanation of that?
We started the show by talking about protections and systems of protection and how they've had to become more elaborate over time. Well, the first thing I would say, and this is outside the systems that I'll describe in a minute, but the Jewish population did reach a peak in the 1930s, 1940s, but it has been contracting in the West since that point. So whereas Jews might have expanded at their peak into your average little town in Pennsylvania or various places, there has been a contraction back towards the major cities. So yes, New York will be booming with Jews right now, but rural New Hampshire won't be in the way that it might have around 1915, 1920. So there has been a slight contraction. So there are many millions of people out there who don't encounter Jews on a personal level in their day-to-day lives. So that is important. That is important because when the day-to-day interaction is reduced or it becomes a city phenomenon, and cities are notoriously anonymous places in which to live out one's life and in which identity is by necessity diluted in any event, then representation of the Jew becomes dependent on broader culture. And in that sense, Jews have overwhelmingly, certainly since the 1960s, acquired many of the tools of culture within the West. So when you think about academia, the media, movie theaters, regular theaters, music production, most obviously politics, when you have all of those factors coming together, then it's more difficult for your average person to pick up a discourse about Jews or to learn what is going on about Jews or their actions. They may perceive, due to the increased elaboration of our socioeconomic lives in the last 50 years alone, that they are being victimized, but they might perceive that as they're being victimized by the banks, that the TV is just getting trashier or whatever it might be. But the explanations for these things become increasingly diffuse because the media is itself dishonest and is part of vested interest. So there's two things already. There's a confusion about modern life and where these different threads and strands of discontent can lead. And there's also the reduction of everyday contact with Jews who are increasingly occupying elite positions within cities and more concentrated areas. A third factor is that our societies have become more multicultural, and this is by design. And this also contributes to the increased anonymity of the Jews. They cease being the exclusive other within Western European society. They begin to become one among many other ethnic minorities who are brought in, bring their own antagonistic behaviors, which may seem more immediate. For example, the Muslim population in France is far greater than that of the Jewish population in France. So it has that extensive geographical spread that Jews would have had in the early 19th century through the early 20th century. And that expansiveness and all of that everyday friction is happening between Muslims and Europeans, Muslims and Americans. And the Muslims are bringing with them terrorism and different things. And of course, Jews did the same when they were in that phase as well. They were involved in anarchistic terrorism in the West, with the bombs going off in New York. The Jews were detonating at one point. But all of the immediate antagonisms are occurring between non-Jewish ethnic minorities and whites. And this is again confusing matters. Lots of the narratives about who's causing all this are lost in the immediacy of social conflict that is playing out in our streets. Another reason why anti-Semitism isn't increasing is because of historical narratives and what Europeans European Americans or Europeans, wherever they may be, are told about themselves. Europeans in the early 20th century, stretching back centuries before that, were a self-confident people. They were sure of who they were, they were sure of what they were, they were sure and proud of their accomplishments. But one of the things that's happened in the last 50 years is that self-assurance and self-confidence, sense of purpose and destiny that was part and parcel of the European existence has been destroyed. It has been imploded. It has been broken down by a very hostile dialectic developed by Jewish intellectuals in academia, politics, and the media. And what that does is makes the footing upon which Europeans stand very unsure. The position that one requires in order to critique another ethnic group assumes some kind of self-worth and self-confidence in the person making the critique. And when that confidence is undermined, then critique becomes less likely, because the person who lacks that self-esteem or that lack of ethnic identity begins to look inward. He starts becoming navel-gazing and focused on his own flaws or his own role in creating the problems that he faces, whether or not that may be the case. So there's a whole spread of reasons as to why anti-Semitism is not where it should be if we were looking at it from the perspective of, right, there's extensive antagonistic behavior here, why isn't provoking the same response? Mm-hmm. Well, the context has changed completely is the short answer. The context has completely changed, and much of that is by design. Mm-hmm. And for there to be a similar counter-agitation against Jewish adversarial behavior to what there was in the early 20th century, for that to occur now would require vast effort and a vast awakening, the likes of which couldn't even have been imagined by those in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Some people in our movement often look back to that period and view those people as having achieved great things. Mm-hmm. But they achieved things in an environment that was largely theirs for the taking. It wasn't easy, but it was vastly easier than what we face today. Our challenges are significantly more difficult. And while we may look at that as a negative and say to ourselves, this is hopeless, it's my personal belief that we should always strive for the heroic. Mm-hmm. And the stakes are so much higher, and when the odds are so much more stacked against us, then I think in the truest tradition of our people, we should strive for all the more glory that such a victory would bring to us. And certainly there would be such an amount of heroism attached to such a victory that songs would be sung for many centuries.
Well, in a way, some of the things that were suggested in the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion that was circulated 100 years ago by Henry Ford and others, a lot of what was being talked about then might have seemed kind of almost far-fetched, but in the course of 100 years, so much of what had been prophesized is now demonstrably the case. There are these crises, the migrant crisis in Europe, where people are just walking across the borders and massive upsurge in crime, and you really have to close your eyes and cover your ears in order to pretend that within the lifetime of a young person, whites aren't going to become a minority in a very embattled and resented minority in country after country where they've been the majority or the only population for so long. These crises are huge. And even just thinking of this presidential election that's going to happen in about 5 weeks in America, you may have Donald Trump win, which would be very interesting in and of itself. But if he doesn't win, after having this massive onslaught against him, full court press against him in the press and in the establishment, I don't know what would happen then. There would be a great deal of resentment. So, I mean, you could say it's a puzzle, that level of awareness of Jewish power and criticism of Jewish behavior has been so low, although you've explained why that's the case. And if you have Jewish domination of the media, of academia, of the elite, then obviously, yeah, they can keep a lid on that type of thing, but only so long. And you have the migrant crisis, you've got this insane Black Lives Matter rioting and violence against whites, and it's reaching the point where people's eyes are probably going to be forced open. So, I mean, that's how I see it. I really don't know how it's going to play out, but those are my final observations. Do you have any final thoughts on this before we wrap this show up?
No, I think you've summed everything up very well, Patrick.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being on the show again, Professor Joyce. This has been very edifying to me, and I'm sure to the rest of our listeners. And I look forward very much to having you on again.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. This has been National Bugle Radio with Patrick Slattery, and we will see you next time.
Mold and mildew describe your basement or crawl space? It doesn't have to be that way. Transform them into a fresh, healthy, usable one with the technologically advanced Wave Moisture Control Units. The computerized operation maximizes moisture control and also expels harmful radon, combustion gases, and numerous other pollutants. Dehumidifiers are old technology that do nothing for air quality and waste energy. Wave units are intelligent, self-monitoring, do not need maintenance, and will save you hundreds in electricity. Wave units are still running effectively. effectively over 15 years. They've been tested and installed in public and military housing and by property managers nationwide. Buy a unit now, and if your home is not fresher and drier, you can return it for a full refund for up to 12 months. What have you got to lose? Call now. 1-888-618-WAVE. 1-888-618-WAVE. Or visit MyDryHome.com. That's MyDryHome.com.
Wave Home Solutions for a healthy, comfortable home.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.